This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast. You simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone or tablet and search for DC 37 State of the Union. There are now more ways to stay in touch with us than ever before. You can check out the website, www.dc37.net. Follow us on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you have any comments about our show or would like to like us to promote a community event, please drop us a line at State of the Union. That's one word, State of the Union at dc37.net. Back in February, former New York Times labor reporter Steve Greenhouse was on our air, and he was in the throes of working on a book. That book is now out. It is called Beaten Down, Worked Up: The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. It examines where we are now and where we are going. And welcome to the show, sir.
Great to be here, my friend.
Obviously, this has been an arduous task producing this work. It has gotten incredible reviews. The Washington Post loved it. I got emails from folks saying how much they liked it. And the Los Angeles Times has weighed in with some. And your own colleague, Nicholas Kristof, has written an incredible column.
He called it superb, important, and eminently readable. And my parents were smiling up in heaven when they read that.
I have to say, I read The Big Squeeze, and The Big Squeeze struck me as someone in the labor world, as a kind of depressing state of affairs. This is something else. Something has gotten into your soul, has gotten into your spirit. You are writing about hope a lot.
Yes. So my first book, The Big Squeeze, was really, I was a reporter covering labor for The New York Times for 19 years. And I saw that in many ways, things are getting worse and worse and worse for labor, for workers, even as corporate profits were at a record and Wall Street was at a record and employee productivity per hour was at a record. Sounds a little like today. Right. And that workers were taking it on the chin. Wages were not keeping up with inflation. Corporations were fighting to cut health coverage, to cut pensions. And it was a phenomenon that I felt people weren't, paying enough attention to. And I got off my behind and decided to write a book. Then this book, my book editor asked me to write a history of labor. And I said, I'm not a real historian who works with archival stuff, but I know a whole lot about, about current unions and what current workers face. So we reached a compromise. So the book is like half history, looking about how the rise of unions in the United States and what unions have accomplished. And one of my concerns and my editor's concern is that far too many Americans, especially younger Americans, really have little idea, they know very little about unions and what they've accomplished. So I wrote a book that, kind of explains the rise of unions and some of the great strikes and confrontations over American history, this great uprising of the 20,000 garment workers strike, female garment workers in 1909 in New York, a great confrontation that the workers won, the great Flint sit-down strike of 1936-37 against General Motors, where the UAW, after years of being crushed by General Motors, and by crushed I mean, company spies infiltrated the unions and police on horseback really beat up strikers, they won union recognition from what was then, GM, the world's largest, most powerful corporation. And then I write about Walter Reuther and the great Memphis sanitation workers' victory, which was a victory both for labor rights and for civil rights. So that was all very hopeful. And then I felt I needed to write about, the decline of labor from a peak of 35% of all workers in the U.S. to now just 10%, and why that has happened.
Why has that happened?
Why has that happened? I'll get to that in a second, Chris. But then the last third of the book really looks at hopeful examples. I say in the book, one of points I really try to hammer in the book is that unfortunately, worker power in the U.S. has fallen to its lowest level probably since World War II or the Great Depression, because union density is so low and because corporate power is so overwhelming. I have this, you know, these two mind-blowing statistics that in the 2016 election cycle, corporate America spent $3.4 billion and unions spent less than 1/16 as much, $213 million. And another mind-blowing statistic is that each year corporate America spends just under $3 billion on lobbying in Washington, whereas unions spend less than 1/60 as much, $48 million. So you wonder, why did Donald Trump and the Republicans rush to pass a $1.5 trillion tax cut when corporate profits were already at record levels, income inequality, the 1% had the highest amount since the 1920s, and why are, you know, Republicans so reluctant to do very basic things like raise the minimum wage or pass paid sick days or paid parental leave? We, you know, one of the points I make is that, you know, we are the only industrial country in the world that doesn't have laws guaranteeing paid parental leave, paid maternal leave, paid vacation, paid sick days. And I call this our unfortunate anti-worker exceptionalism. So I write about models on how we can hopefully restore worker power, public financing of campaigns. That Redford teacher strikes are a great example of, you know, teachers in Arizona, Oklahoma, West Virginia, who are like really beaten down with wage freezes and you know, swelling class sizes, and they kind of, you know, banded together through Facebook, through other means, like, we're not going to take it anymore. And that's, I think, a terrific example of reestablishing worker power. Fight for 15, I have a chapter on that. That's another great example of...
You're moving
okay,
very quickly.
Now, okay, so to answer your question, so you want a five-minute answer, why have unions declined for...
No. What is the... Here's my question. It didn't happen by accident. And your book makes clear, I think, at various points of just how, and you just said in this, there was a very powerful, not lobby, forces against labor. And in fact, they turned around and made it seem as if big, powerful unions were what was wrong with America.
So. You know, I explain in that, you know, coming out of World War, you know, during World War II, kind of business and labor held hands. They worked together. They were really partners. Like, we're going to defeat Nazism. We're going to defeat the Axis. And I think that partnership and you know, mutual good relations carried over into the 1950s and 1960s. And unions won these great contracts that really established the middle class and, you know, the highest wages in the world.
And CEOs were still the rich guys with the big house on the hill. And they made
20 times as much, whereas now they make 300 times as much. Yes. So the 1970s, for, you know, your older listeners will remember, were a difficult time economically because of the two big oil crises in 1973 and 1979, and that caused inflation to soar. And those are difficult times. So come 1980, inflation was running, you know, well above 10%. And then all these horrible things happened in the 1980s that really hurt unions very badly. One, the Federal Reserve greatly raised interest rates to 20% to crack down on inflation. That caused what was then the worst recession since 1929, since the Great Depression. And that caused unemployment to soar. That caused, you know, huge factory overcapacity, caused, you know, corporate profits to plunge. At the same time, right around 1980, we really felt a huge wave of imports for the first time since World War II. Your cars from Japan, Volkswagens from Germany, steel from Romania, Brazil, Russia, all these countries. So corporate America was like, crap, we have this horrible recession, you know, second terrible, we have all these imports coming in, and they figure, how are we going to cut our costs? How are we going to cut over capacity? How are we going to restore our profits? And they figured one way to do that was really go after unions with a vengeance. And at that time was the rise of Milton Friedman and the Chicago School of Economics. And we want free market, free market, free market, and let management, let it rip and be flexible. And like, unions are also seen as a obstacle as a wrench in the gears that messed up everything. And the fourth thing that I know you want to ask me about is Ronald Reagan and the air traffic controller strike. So, you know, Reagan was elected in 1980, inaugurated in January 1981, and a few months later, the air traffic controllers, who are federal employees who vowed, you know, their first day of work never to go on strike, they were very frustrated. They felt their pay was too low. They had an extremely stressful job. It's, you're trying to land all these aircraft and help them take off without, you know, you make one little mistake and people die. So, you know, they thought we were very valuable employees. They thought they were very underpaid. So they had these fairly exorbitant demands to have, you know, wage increases 2-3 times that of other federal employees. Also, they wanted to get those huge raises while going from a 5-day week to a 4-day week. And Reagan, his administration, which was a conservative administration, wasn't eager to give these big raises. They said, this is just out of line with what everyone else is getting. There's no justification for that. And if we give you these big raises, then the postal unions, which are, you know, 30 times as you folks, 30 times as big as you folks, are going to demand the same thing, and we can't afford it. So there was this, you know, deadlock, and that the air traffic controllers went on strike. 13,000 went on strike, and Reagan surprised them by saying, if you don't return to work within 48 hours, you'll all be fired. About 1,500 returned to work, and 11,300 were fired, and the union really got its head handed to it. The union got crushed, and I think the message that corporate America took from that is, if the president of the United States can be super tough toward unions and could fire strikers, we too can be super tough towards unions. And we really saw a change in attitude towards unions where, you know, there are various strikes, Greyhound, Phelps Dodge, where International Paper, where management took a far tougher attitude. They replaced hundreds of strikers. Before the 1980s, corporate America really didn't replace workers permanently when they went on strike. But after PATCO, that we saw a whole lot of that, and unions got much more frightened about going on strike because they worried that their members would lose their jobs.
So we've done now half the show, and it feels as if we just started. I'm talking with Steve Greenhouse. The book is called Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. We're talking with Steven Greenhouse, whose new book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor, is out. Steve Greenhouse, how long did you spend working on this book?
4 years.
That's...
And it's, I love working in the New York Times. You're working along you know, alongside all these wonderful, brilliant folks, you schmooze together, you go to lunch together. Writing a book is lonely work. It's very different.
But you were, I mean, when you left the Times officially, you were what I thought was one of the most prolific freelance writers I've ever seen. I mean, you were doing, you were publishing a lot in a lot of different places. So clearly you had a certain rhythm to that. And then the hard part is sitting down with a book.
I've had three op-ed pieces posted today by The Guardian, The LA Times, and Time Magazine on pieces based on my book. So I still remain active.
Okay. Good. Listen, let's talk about, because this is, DC 37 is an AFSCME union. AFSCME is very proud of a chapter of its history that involved Martin Luther King and the strike in Memphis. Talk, if you will, a little bit about the unions and racial equality, Martin Luther King and Memphis.
Sure. So I, you know, this book had, about half this book is the history of labor, and I really tried to focus on the most important, most interesting episodes, and I tried to make it really interesting. So in my chapter, and one of the great chapters in labor history was the Memphis sanitation worker strike, and I was down in Memphis, and I interviewed at length some of the workers, and I profiled one of the workers. Elmore Nickelberry, you know, he's in his mid-80s now, nicest guy in the world. And he said, you know, he was a veteran of the Korean War, comes back to Memphis to look for a job, and he can't find a job. And he's just like, he was, you know, a corporal, and now everyone's just calling him boy. And, like, he's just, he can't find a regular job, so he takes a job in the sanitation department. And he says, you know, he worked there 14 years, and he was still making basically the minimum wage. He said, you know, the job was to go into backyards with a plastic tub, and they carry the tub on their heads or on their shoulders, and the tub would be leaking and you know, there'd be maggots and garbage juice, you know, streaming down his back and his legs. And, you know, and in the garages where they went after work, there were no showers. And you know, the white workers were promoted. African-American workers were very rarely promoted. The pay was terrible. You know, many of them were on their families were on welfare, even though they were working full time. And at some point, and then these two young workers were crushed to death in a malfunctioning garbage truck. And the union, you know, there was an incipient unionization effort by AFSCME, and they were saying, you know, we told you years ago you got to fix these trucks. And then once those two men died, you know, the workers are really up in arms saying, we're not going to take it anymore. And some great organizers from AFSCME and the workers, you know, engage in this huge strike. And the mayor just didn't want to deal with the union. He's from a super duper anti-union family. And Dr., you know, the religious leaders of Memphis, you know, got very involved helping. And they asked Dr. King to come in. And he helped out saying, you know, he was planning the poor person's
poor people's campaign,
and he thought this is part and parcel of the poor people's campaign. These are people working full time, you know, in government jobs, and they're, you know, they're very poor. So he gave some amazing speeches there, but
he gave his last speech.
He gave and then, you know, the day before this big demonstration, this big march, he was there giving a speech, and he gave, you know, one of the most amazing speeches we've ever heard. You know, been to the mountaintop.
But he was also he also understood income inequality. He also understood what right to work was about, and the the lie of right to work. So even though, as you write in the book about the racial disharmony within the labor movement, he understood the value of unions and the value of labor.
I have this great quote from Dr. King. The labor movement was the principal force that transformed misery and despair into hope and progress. Out of its bold struggles, economic and social reform gave birth to unemployment insurance, old age pensions, government relief for the destitute, and above all, new wage levels that meant not mere survival, but a tolerable life. The captains of industry did not lead this transformation. They resisted it until they were overcome.
Exactly.
And so I write about this wonderful, big-hearted sanitation worker, you know, Elmore Nickelberry. And, you know, when I talked to him about Dr. King's death, you know, he was like crying as I interviewed him. And he realized that, you know, after this grueling strike where they had these very eloquent I am a man sign, they finally won. And he said, you know, with the union, we got a raise. We got showers. Like, showers are really a big thing.
Absolutely.
We got better working conditions. We got health benefits. Before, we had to pay doctor bills ourselves. The union came in, and we got respect, he told me. They stopped calling us boy. And he told me, you know, the union did a great job. If we didn't have a union, we would get nothing. We'd be in the same shape as before. You got a union to back you, you achieve more. The more people you have in a union, the more you get. They can talk for you more than you could talk for yourself.
There you go. There you go. Okay, the other chapter of labor history that you talk about in the book that is AFSCME related has to do with Scott Walker and the siege of Wisconsin.
So the first third of the book is kind of the rise of labor and, you know, some of labor's huge victories. The middle is kind of the decline of labor and some of its big defeats. One was the air traffic controller strike in 1981. Fast forward 30 years later, Scott Walker declared war on unions. And I explain in detail in this chapter that while Scott Walker says it was just to help, you know, hold down government costs on wages and health benefits, you know, there was a real secret agenda. It was to, like, you know, it was chop unions off at the knees.
It was
because
secret,
they supported.
Though, it was so secret, though, it wasn't part of his campaign.
Right.
He never campaigned on this.
Yeah. I quote the Sheboygan Press newspaper saying, you know, he ran saying, you know, I'm going to hold down the budget. He never hinted for a second that he was going to try, you know, chopping off unions at the knees. And he, you know, and there was this humongous fight where AFSCME was very, very involved in that. You know, Wisconsin was the first state in the nation that passed a law to allow public sector bargaining. The very, very first local in AFSCME's history is in Madison, Wisconsin. And I profile the young woman who heads that local, and she, brilliant woman, very dedicated, and she says, you know, since this crazy law basically eviscerated unions and said, you know, you have to vote each year just to keep your union, and the odds are stacked against that, you know, this local has gone from 1,100 members to 80 members. And you know, I, in my book, I quote, you know, former AFSCME president Jerry AFSCME during these Jerry McEntee of AFSCME, you know, during these humongous demonstrations of 30, 50, even 100,000 people. And Jerry said, we know what this is about. It's about making sure the only people who have a say in American politics are the well-heeled and politically connected. And he said, if they succeed in Wisconsin, the birthplace of AFSCME, they will be emboldened to attack worker rights in every state. And Jerry was right, because after this, they passed a similar law in Ohio that the voters reversed in a referendum. Iowa, with very little notice, passed like a carbon copy law 2 years ago, 2017, that also eviscerates guts of public sector unions. And I make the point that this very much hurts workers. You know, they're getting much less in terms of raises, and it's really hurt, you know, it's cut, you know, union membership in Wisconsin is down 43% by 166,000 members since, you know, Scott Walker's law has passed. And people talk about, why did Hillary Clinton lose Wisconsin? She lost Wisconsin by 22,000 votes in 2016, and union membership fell by 166,000. So you can imagine, if Scott Walker hadn't done this thing to zap unions, you know, the Democrats would have done much better there.
And you very clearly lay that out, because this is about political power. And again, you believe, I believe from the book and other writings, that the unions really are the force that equalizes the playing field, levels the playing field.
So I quote the economist John Kenneth Galbraith, who said, you know, unions play an important role as a countervailing power to corporate power. And now when you look at, you know, what's, you know, how our government is being run, you know, that, you know, it's letting, you know, it's, you know, every day it bows over to fossil fuel interests and ignores climate change and gives the pharmaceutical industry too much sway and banks. And it's, I argue it's largely, largely because that worker power and unions have grown so weak that they no longer serve the they're no longer the check, they're no longer the countervailing power on corporations and on government. And you know, why did this crazy tax cut pass that gave over $1 trillion to corporations when they didn't need it and to the rich when they didn't need it? It's because, you know, unions and worker power are not nearly strong enough. And I try to outline different avenues on how we as a nation could, you know, expand, rebuild worker power, union power to create a fairer, more democratic nation.
I want to talk a little bit about, we've only got a couple minutes left, so we've got to be tight on this, union leadership and the stereotypical leaders of the past and the people that we have running, certainly the public employee unions now. We have an African-American, two women, two gay women, Randy Weingarten, Mary Kay Henry, Lee Saunders, the head of AFSCME, the change in the leadership. And then I would like you to talk a little bit about Larry Hanley and Hector Figueroa, two folks who we've lost and we miss.
So 10 years ago, we used to hear the joke that, you know, unions are pale, male, and stale. And a lot of them were run by, you know, 63-year-old white guys. And then you look at what's happened in you know, the nation's four largest unions. They're led by women. They're led by an African-American. The NEA, the nation's largest union, is led by a Hispanic woman. So things have really changed. And these are really dynamic people. You know, Mary Kay, Randy, Lee, and Lily at NEA. And like, this is an impressive change. And then there's some terrific leaders, you know, a smaller, you know, Larry Hanley, a good progressive, you know, fighting man, you know, for the ATU. He was a real force in New York and in Washington. And Hector Figueroa, who was head of Local 32 BJ with 175,000 members in New York, representing building workers, janitors, window cleaners, you know, to my mind, was one of the finest union leaders I ever met. He was, you know, if every union in the United States had someone like Hector leading it, we would be not just a different labor movement, but a different nation. You know, Hector, you know, was instrumental in pushing the fight for 15. His union local added 50,000 members over the past 7-8 years. How many unions could say they did that? He was instrumental in getting Governor Cuomo, the Port Authority, to agree to a $19 an hour minimum wage, the highest minimum wage in the nation, for 40,000 workers at New York's airport. So, you know, Larry and Hector were really impressive, and I think the labor movement would be much better off if there were more leaders like them.
Stephen, I knew it was going to fly by. It flew by. Thank you very much. The book is Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. We have spent the last half hour with Stephen Greenhouse, and it was informative, enlightening, and as I say, hopeful. Thank you for being with us.
Great to be here, Chris.
That's just about all the time we have tonight. I want to thank our guest again, Steve Greenhouse, for joining us. A message before we go. The Municipal Employees Housing Program holds their annual housing fair Saturday, August 24th at 10 a.m. at 125 Barclay Street. For details, please call 212-815-1814. And remember to join us at the annual Labor Day Parade, Saturday, September 7th. DC 37 members will assemble at 11 a.m. at West 48th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues. For details, contact your local or union rep or call 212-815-1550. Any comments about today's shows or any of our shows, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The sound engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I am Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.